Welcome back. Q&A time. I know there's been a few months there where we haven't got to Q&As. It feels like this is the first one for the year for some reason.
Yeah.
I almost forgot how to do it, but thankfully answering questions comes naturally to me, Tim. So we should be fine. So part one, April Q&A. We should be doing these every month from this point forward. Actually, Computex is coming up, so that might throw a spanner in the works there. Anyway, part one, let's get into it. Today's sponsor spot is brought to you by Thermal Grizzly and their CryoSheet graphene thermal pads, which are an excellent alternative to thermal pastes. They offer very high thermal conductivity with no liquid components, so they can't dry out and therefore don't degrade over time like pastes and even liquid metals. CryoSheet is very easy to use, it's extremely durable, and is available in a range of sizes to suit most applications. I've personally done some high-end GPU testing with CryoSheet, and the results were impressive, very similar in fact to that of liquid metal, but without the mess, and of course, no risk of drying out. So for more information, please check the link in the video description.
Your thoughts on the 12-volt HP WR melting problems. Okay. As there are now about 200 a month that goes in for repair that we know about now, I don't see them fixing this problem. There's just too few pins for the power they're trying to push. The limited contact surface of the contact makes it physically impossible to carry 600 watts without any problems. Safety ratio just isn't there. So I guess firstly with the, we should probably address like the 200 a month claim. You know, this is, there have been reports about this. There's a YouTuber that runs a repair shop where this person has made this claim. They've shown some, you know, connectors and stuff that they've been replacing at their shop. But ultimately, you know, this is just a claim from one repair shop. So we're not really sure how widespread that is. Like, is that representative of all shops? Is this one shop just happening to get more units in for repair than usual? And yeah, it's hard to say. Like, we don't have a number of reports to corroborate that. So it's hard to say how widespread of a problem is. And really, I would have thought that most people would have sent their cards in for an RMA rather than sending it to a repair shop, but maybe the RMA is going to a repair shop. I don't know how that works.
That's exactly what I was just thinking. Like, so that's what, 50 a week, basically?
Yeah.
Let's say that's the average. I mean, first of all, damn, how long does it take to fix one of those things? Like, one repair shop, they must have a backlog, right? Like, that's a lot of work.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I mean,
they might have to be cranking them out, basically.
I'm working under the assumption they have other work they do. They don't just work on burnt 4090s. But again, we're not challenging the claim because we have no idea. I would, you know, are there other sources claiming, like other repair shops or other? And the repair shop thing, again, I find it confusing because if I had a burnt, if I bought a 4090 and the connector melted,
mm-hmm.
I'd be sending it back to the shop that I purchased it from, who would then be going through the regular RMA process, and that goes back to MSI, ASUS, or whoever made the card, and usually they repair it or they don't usually outsource that to a store. So that part of it I find a bit confusing, but I'm sure there's an explanation that I am unaware of that goes towards explaining that.
Yeah, it seemed like a lot of the connectors were like affected by the cable mod situation and they're recalled adapter thingo that
could
angle them or whatever. But yeah, it seems a little strange to me. I'd find it hard to believe that is a widespread situation for repair shops, that they are receiving that amount
of
cards.
Like, but this is like when we're talking about the Intel stability problem.
Yeah.
You know, 5700 XT is black screening, AM5 sockets burning up. All these problems, it's really hard for us to get a handle on how widespread it is and how much of a problem it really is. I run two 4090s in my personal rigs daily. They spend a lot of time under full load. To my knowledge, last time I checked, neither of them had a problem. Maybe I should pull the connectors out and check. But they've been fine. I know this is a small sample size. Then I've got two in my test systems. I think you run one, don't you?
I've got one in my gaming rig. I've got one in my test system. So I've got two.
We've got about half a dozen of them that they're the original connector that have been in use since day one, and none of them have had any problems. Now, that isn't to say that this isn't a problem, because it very much is. It's just trying to get a handle on how widespread it is and how likely you are to have a problem. Now,
I'd say that if one store is getting 50 a week, which effectively means that they need one person employed just to deal with that problem,
an absurd amount,
then this would be like most people having to return their 4090s to have this problem repaired, because that would be, how many repair shops are there in just the United States or Australia alone? Like there'd be hundreds of places. So you'd be talking about tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of connectors worldwide that are being replaced, almost all of them.
I reached out to a few contacts at distributors and retailers, and I haven't got all of the information back, so I've only got a little bit of the information back from a few of them that I wanted to get for this, but I just, sometimes this information can be a bit sensitive or a bit difficult to get. But so far the information I've got is they've confirmed that, they have had RMA issues relating to melted connectors in the past, more when they were first released. But the ones that did get back to me have said more recently, very little to no problems with melted connectors. So that is odd. And they're still selling 4090s and in reasonable volumes, and they're not seeing this problem. So I'm not really sure what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Something that would make the most sense to me would be that some distributor is outsourcing that particular workshop to do this work for them. Like, I don't know whether that's the case or not, obviously, but that would be something that would make the most sense to me. Like, just spitballing about how that could work just based on the information we're hearing. But again, I don't want to dismiss this is not an issue, because clearly there's photographic evidence of it occurring.
Mm-hmm.
So there is definitely is a problem.
So our thoughts on the problem, it's clearly a failed connector, because we shouldn't be talking about melting connectors, period. It should definitely not be a thing. So something's definitely gone wrong. Whether it's user error or not, we're not claiming it is or it isn't. We're just talking about all the information that's out there. But if you say that it's user error, then it's not a user-friendly connector and there's problems there.
It's basically flawed connector either way.
So it's a flawed connector either way. But clearly a problem, not something you want to see on a flagship graphics card that costs $1,600 US plus.
Mm-hmm.
So big fail there. I'm not sure if any of the updates they've made have improved the situation. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's a tough one for us to comment on, because, as I said, we've got quite a few of these cards in use and we've seen no problems yet. On my gaming PC, I bought two relatively cheap extension connectors to wire into 4/8 pins. I got them off Amazon. They were like $14 Australian.
Wow, that's going to be a high quality.
They look good. They're braided cables. They look nice.
Yep.
I've been running those in my gaming PC since day one. I ripped them out probably about 3 months ago. No problems. Haven't checked them since. So maybe we'll do that after this and see. But I fully expect them to be perfectly fine.
Well, if we're hearing that the RMAs are coming, not too many of them are coming in from sources in the industry that we have, then, and I think that's a pretty good indication of how widespread.
I haven't heard back from everyone yet, but so far what I have heard is that it isn't a problem that they're aware of. That it's a problem they've had, but it hasn't been an ongoing problem, and there isn't large quantities of people RMAing the cards from melted connectors that they're aware of.
And I think if there were this level of number, as in like 200 a month or whatever across a wide number of repair outlets, that NVIDIA probably would have updated the card, because the amount of money that they would be spending dealing with returns, shipping cards back, replacing connectors, they would have done a revision, because there's just no way that they'd be footing that bill, because they're continuing to produce the card. It's a very popular GPU. It's not like they produce one run that all had an issue and then there was no more production of that model. Mm. They're continuing to produce it. It's in high demand. If there was significant issues, significant widespread issues continuing on, in my opinion, that would justify some sort of revision to the product.
I'll keep talking to my contacts and seeing what they come back with. But so far, a bit of a weird one.
Yep.
All right. I'll be interested if you actually have anything to say about this one. If AM4 is the greatest platform ever, which I think we both agree that it is, and I think most people would, what is the second best platform?
Right.
I know what mine is.
I would go back to like LGA 775, way back.
Okay,
A lot of overclocking potential on those platforms. You could get a few generations. I can't remember exactly how many generations were supported on there, but I think it was more than the usual amount from an Intel CPU. We can fact check that on the screen. But that was a really great platform that comes to my mind as sort of, the CPUs were powerful, good features.
Yeah, it was the crossover from dual core to quad core.
Yeah, you had dual core, quad cores came out on that platform. So that was a really good platform. But I don't imagine you have the same answer. You seem surprised when I said LGA 775.
No, there wasn't so much that I was surprised. It was funny when I was, because I read this question a few hours ago and I had a bit of a think about it. And that I was actually tossing up between that platform and 1155. So the second and third gen. Your Core i7 2600, the 2500K Core i5. Those sort of CPUs went down as being fairly legendary. And I was thinking about what makes a platform the best or the greatest. And if we hadn't have got, say, the X3D CPUs on AM4, I don't think it would be anywhere near as good as what it turned out to be. I think they made the legendary. Yep. It was still, because first gen Ryzen was eh. Zen Plus was okay. Zen 3 was quite good.
And then
we got the Zen 3 3D V-Cache stuff.
Well, the X3D made it properly competitive with Intel.
And Zen 2, I shouldn't have skipped, was the first step in a competitive direction, I think. And then Zen 3 was good. And then the X3D stuff for Zen 3 was good. So that's what gets it there, is the CPUs. If the CPUs were all stinkers, like FX-type stuff, then it doesn't matter if it had a support 30 generations. If they all aren't worth buying, then it's a failed platform. But out of the gate, you can make a case for buying like a Ryzen 7 processor, and even the Ryzen 5s were cheap. The Zen Plus stuff improved them, and so it kept improving, and there was good processors the whole way along, and then you got the 16 core models and stuff like that.
But obviously that Intel platform, LGA 1155, you got banger CPUs straight out of the gate. And when you did buy into that platform, you could use that CPU for an astonishingly long period of time, which is why well into like the AM4 generation, people were still tossing up like, I've got my 2600K or whatever. Do I finally bite the bullet and change over to a newer platform? So that had longevity in kind of a different way. You weren't getting a lot of CPU upgrades, but the CPUs were good enough and lasted for such a long time that it was well worth making that investment if you did buy into that platform.
Yeah, the second one's tough for me. I'm not really sure. Like, I went with 1155 because if you bought a 2500K or a 2600K, you had them right up till Skylake, and then maybe even Skylake, you're like, there's not a huge amount of extra gain. It was probably around 8th gen that you would have considered upgrading, or a lot of people, the diehard 2nd and 3rd gen owners. So, I'd go with either platform, but, I'm leaning more towards probably your pick. I'd have to go back and look at all the CPUs that were on offer there. I remember the great overclocking headroom, and then, the Q6600? That was a great CPU. A lot of, that sold in huge numbers for back then. So, your pick's probably the best second pick, I would have thought.
Yeah.
All right, Tim. Good one here for you, I think, because it says hypothetically.
Oh, I love a hypothetical.
If hypothetically Zen 6 was on a new platform and AM5 ended with Zen 5, what do you think Zen 6 would have to bring to justify that early change in platform? So Zen 5 is obviously coming up this year, we imagine. But then, so that means we'd get two CPUs like we do with Intel on the one platform, and then we'd be going to a new platform, which, obviously, we hate, not something we're into, but for us not to hate it and for us to be like, okay, this is worth it, even though that would be a stretch. But let's say that scenario took place, what would it be? I think for me, it's pretty simple, right? It would have to be, regardless of, because normally we say, DDR6.
Yeah, DDR7, like new features.
New memory sort of features. So we've obviously gone to DDR5 with AM5. Don't think we're moving from that anytime soon. But it would have to be other than new features, because you don't want to just go to DDR6, for example, and have no, like you get the standard, maybe let's say 10% IPC improvement. So it's a 10% performance uplift. And initially you don't see a huge improvement with memory.
Yeah. Yep.
So having just new memory is not justification for, you know, ditching a platform. So I think the simplest way to put it is it would have to be significantly more powerful, significantly better performance outside of the usual.
Yeah, I think it'd have to be both, because you could have a significant performance improvement still in the same socket. So there'd have to be some technical justification for why the new super powerful Zen 6 CPU,
I guess they could say,
is not compatible with that socket.
They could just say, to achieve this significant performance increase, like, it could be justified, and it'd be sort of fair enough. They could say, look, we could have designed this new architecture around AM5, and it wouldn't have been anywhere near as impressive.
It'd have to be true, though.
Yeah.
Not just marketing BS.
But it's difficult. Like, you know, NVIDIA's made claims about DLSS and things like that. You have to take them at their word to a degree, unless you can prove otherwise, right?
Yes.
So I can just see Tim walking into the AMD fabs and just being like, no, I'm not buying it, guys. Prove to me why this architecture. He comes out 6 months later and he's probably right.
Well, I think, like, if it required DDR6 memory, that's like an obvious reason why
sure.
the AM5 platform wouldn't be suitable.
But they can still say for architectural reasons. And what are you going to say to that?
Well, I would say that, you know, maybe make more of an effort to put an AM5. I mean,
in all your wisdom, you're like, I reckon.
Well, they how much of a performance improvement gains were they able to get from AM4? Pretty huge gains over the years.
That's true.
If they've suddenly after, they're on their third generation.
I'm not trying to justify this. I'm against this option. I'm just saying, what would it take for us to be on board?
Yeah, I mean, it would have to be obviously very powerful, good value, and I would say on top of that, have some provable feature that you could point to and be like, that was not achievable in AM5. And one of those things may be simply that the CPU size is larger. So, you know, they're trying to put more cores in it or something.
So that's fairly obvious.
And I would think, you know, if they want to go more down the APU route and, you know, they are thinking of these more powerful laptop-based APUs where they, you know, have much bigger GPUs in them, more than two memory channels would be something that would be a justification for a new platform. You know, we've been on two memory channels for how long? Maybe quad memory channels would be nice. So those are the sorts of features that I would think of that would justify a new platform in addition to performance. But yeah, I guess it would be a borderline case, right? If they sort of said, this is powerful, it requires a new platform, but there's no obvious thing you could look at. It's sort of like, do you take them on their word or do you not?
It's something that they wouldn't get away without some sort of backlash, because let's just say, let's say something that was absurd, like 40% faster.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, some people will say, well, it's worth me spending another $200 on a motherboard to get my $400 CPU for a 40% performance upgrade, and they'll be happy with that. Others would probably say, well, I spent anywhere from $100 to $200, maybe $300 on my motherboard. I would have been happy with a 20 or 30% performance upgrade on that socket without having to. So I can't justify this outright and say there's no way. But essentially, to answer the question, it would have to be a seriously significant performance upgrade to somewhat mislead people into thinking that invest in AM5 and it will go the distance, because that was part of the marketing when they first announced AM5 was platform longevity. And if you're going to advertise platform longevity, it has to be better platform support than what your competitor's been doing forever.
Yeah, I think it'd be a big downgrade to go from AM4 giving you multiple generations, three or four generations on the one platform, plus X3D type stuff, even extending the lifespan, to then go to two generations.
That'd be bad.
I think that would be pretty bad. So let's hope they don't do that.
Yep. Your thoughts on the demise of EK water blocks? I honestly haven't looked into this too much. I haven't had a chance to watch the GN video. Apologies to Steve. I usually like to keep up with their stuff, but I have not had a chance trying to catch up with our own work. But I have the gist of what's going on there. I've heard some of the story, so not great, obviously. But I guess it doesn't, as far as the demise of EK or whatever, that doesn't shock me. I actually find it more surprising that a company like EK can survive.
Yeah, that was my first thought as well.
Yeah, because, you know, we've moved on so much from those sort of niche water cooling companies. Back in the days, you were talking about the second best platform, like LG, was it 775?
Yeah.
You could overclock cooling your CPU. You got really great results cooling your GPU. The 980 Ti or whatever, you could get really good results. I mean, you can do that on a stock cooler, but water cooling's kind of cool. No pun intended.
There were a few AIOs back then as well. They weren't like the custom loop solutions, as far as I know. You have a much longer history with me, but those were available well before the integrated solutions like your Corsair AIOs or whatever.
They were more refined. Yeah. The AIOs for quite a few years were pretty crap. They would, longevity wasn't good. They'd have reliability problems, gunking up, pump failure, all that kind of stuff. So they kind of sucked. So those who took it a bit more seriously always went to the custom open loop stuff. And there was only a handful of companies that did it well, EK being one of them. But for a number of factors, one being that most people simply don't even bother overclocking anymore. If you do, again, AIOs are really good now. So just use one of those or a good tower style cooler, which frankly works just as well. GPU overclocking's pretty well pointless. And there's AIO versions if you want a liquid-cooled one. You can find them varying degrees of success. So there's just not a lot of point to the majority of the products they make. And then the products that make a bit more sense, like the AIOs, every man and his dog makes an AIO now, like G-Skill. Name a company, they'll make one. So, and they don't have to be a dedicated, cooling company like a Deepcool or whatever. There's just so many examples of PSU makers and all the motherboard makers make them now. Asus makes them. Gigabyte, I'm pretty confident, makes them. MSI definitely makes them. So, they're probably their product that makes the most sense is in the most saturated market possible, and having not diversified enough, pretty tough. So it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, I mean, liquid cooling, especially the custom stuff, has always been very expensive. So their target market was always a very small niche group of people. And there's always been the whole, you can make your PC look really awesome with the custom cooling type of stuff. But I think that sort of component was probably going to have to survive as part of a larger brand so that they could even maybe subsidize the manufacturing and making of those components by also having a whole bunch of other stuff. So I'm thinking of like a Corsair as an example, which also offer
probably
custom
killing
stuff.
EK, really.
Yeah, right. So like they can make the revenue that they can make to have the company survive based on selling memory and SSDs and power supplies and cases, all the other components that they make. And then they can have this niche high-end cooling solution for the premium customers that can make your PC look really cool. And then you can almost sell your other products as part of those solutions. So you can, advertise your fans and your hubs and your RGB strips and stuff all integrated into the Corsair system, which is going to incentivize people that are willing to spend the hundreds of dollars on custom liquid cooling into the whole Corsair ecosystem. Whereas EK, they kind of had to survive on partnerships with other brands, making sure that all their components are compatible. And it gets pretty difficult when each, think about a GPU water block, for example, they have to manufacture different versions for different types of cards because each,
How many you're selling.
There's stock cards versus the redesigned PCB.
The tooling required is just mind-boggling.
Yeah, and there were some attempts on motherboards as well, which always seemed like quite, niche components that have to be custom made for that exact board layout and stuff. Yep. So it becomes a pretty complicated solution compared to AIO, a couple of, nice fans on your radiator, maybe changing up a few things there. It becomes hard to survive as a business when you're making that sort of niche product without the price obviously skyrocketing to levels that people really aren't willing to pay. So it's sad to see that they're having some issues and resorting to things like making deals and not paying them by the sounds of things and doing all that sort of stuff. But my first thoughts when I saw the Gamers Nexus video was, at some point this company was probably going to find it difficult to survive, unfortunately. So with Intel constantly improving XeSS and increasing visual quality while FSR is seemingly not receiving much attention from AMD and stagnating, should game developers with limited resources prioritize XeSS integration over FSR? This is a hard question to answer because we've seen AMD announce FSR 3.1, but it's not in any games yet, whereas the latest versions of XeSS 1.3, DLSS 3.7, you can kind of swap those into existing games unofficially, whereas AMD's for some reason made that much more difficult with FSR. So it's hard to compare like the very latest technologies across all the different versions to sort of say, which one is best at the moment. However, based on what we've tested previously, I've generally found XCSS to look better than FSR at a given level of performance, even on AMD GPUs. So yeah, I mean, that would certainly be a reason to integrate XCSS over FSR. It does depend on the performance level of the GPU. So as far as I've seen, like, you go back further and further in generations, XCSS does tend to run worse and worse because you get less and less AI acceleration capabilities, which are even required for some parts of that. So yeah, it's a tough one. I personally would prefer game developers to integrate XCSS over FSR because I think it looks better at the same level of performance based on what I've seen. But there's probably a whole bunch of reasons why they are not doing that. Potentially they want even broader support than what Intel provides, or they've already integrated FSR and are sticking with that as a solution. But ultimately, I think a lot of games that do integrate upscaling have the resources to integrate all of the techniques, especially major AAA games, which are usually the games that are integrating these features. If you're spending $200 million making your game, there is no excuse but having DLSS, FSR, and XCSS in your titles. It just should be the standard these days, and that's what I'd be advocating for the most. Are there potential drawbacks to prioritizing AI capabilities over other performance metrics in modern CPUs? Because AI blocks will take up a large portion of valuable die space that could have been dedicated elsewhere, such as higher core counts, wider caches, etc. So this kind of brings me back to like the early days of ray tracing and DLSS and stuff, where NVIDIA prioritized some die space for use on tensor cores and things like that, and had to justify those features via, you know, releasing DLSS and ray tracing. It took a long time. Ray tracing is still probably a maybe at this point. DLSS is proven now. You know, it's taken a while for those things to be proven when they did dedicate some space, maybe not heaps of space, but some space for those specific features in the hardware way back in 2018 or 2019 or whenever it was. And there's a risk that that's going to happen again with these AI things. You know, if there's some marketing angle that a company can go with, and AI is a massive, massive buzzword at the moment, and they can sort of say, hey, you know, we've put in this AI thing into the hardware, please buy it because AI equals good now, then there could be a risk that most of the traditional workloads that people are still using suffers in some way because they're not prioritizing that anymore. And there's still question marks at the moment about local AI processing. Like, mm-hmm. What is it actually doing? Is there benefits to doing it locally? A lot of the tools that people are using are cloud-based. So things like ChatGPT and a lot of the large language models are run in the cloud. So you don't actually need dedicated AI hardware to do those sorts of things. So there's all question marks around that sort of thing. They kind of have to, if you like DLSS and like ray tracing, if you put the hardware in your silicon, you have to prove that it's necessary for that to happen. So if they want to go down that path, I think we'll be, you know, heavily scrutinizing those sorts of things and sort of saying, you know, what is the use case of those pieces of hardware? Could you have used that silicon more effectively? We're not just going to sit here and accept AMD or Intel or some company advertising, hey, we spent 20% of the die space on AI, but there's no actual use case for this hardware. So why did you do that? We're going to be probably having a look at that. So yeah, we'll see what happens there, but be always be wary of the buzzwords when those things start coming to market. Be very careful that what is being advertised is actually what you're getting, and that they're not just running those things via servers that you're not actually paying for.
Why do you think people are suddenly a lot less vocal about frame gen latency? Is it just coincidental that it happens exactly along with FSR frame gen release? I think it's people have just accepted. Well, I mean, it seems,
yep,
in my opinion, that people seem to have accepted for the most part that frame generation technologies, whether it's FSR based or DLSS or whatever, it's more frame smoothing and it's not a performance enhancer, like an FPS performance enhancer. You're not getting two times whatever performance or whatever the marketing might have said. So it was, I think we both agree that it was mismarketed probably deliberately initially as to what it really did. And then with enough testing by enough different media outlets, I think most people agree that it's more of a frame smoothing technology.
Yeah. I think it's with anything, right? Like, you get a technology that's presented market to you in one way, then you analyze it. And sometimes there's surprising findings. I wouldn't have said maybe that maybe the latency side of things wasn't that surprising, because if you thought about how it was going to work, it was likely not to improve latency.
Mm-hmm.
But you get the results and some people are like, oh, okay, that's a bit of a surprise. And then it becomes this big storm for a little while, mm-hmm. where people, they're figuring out what it does because it's new and there's a whole lot of buzz around and people talking, oh, okay, it does this, you know, frame improving. It may gives you more frames, but the latency's not as good. So then you talk about it a lot and people talk about that being a negative. But then over time, you've already learnt that. Mm-hmm. Like if we talk about frame gen a year later, it's not a surprise anymore that in the latest titles that there's also no latency improvement, because we already talked about that a year ago. And yeah, like there's probably some fanboys that as soon as FSR came out and it had the same challenges that have sort of quieted down on DLSS not really improving latency or not really improving performance because the competing technology does the exact same thing. I think there's probably some people that's a factor. But I think for most people, it's just like it's the cycle of the product. Like,
I think it's understanding.
Yeah.
People have understood now. The marketing garbage is now not first and foremost.
Yeah.
People have understood what the technology is. They've come to terms with what it does.
And they've used it.
So it is what it is. Like, it can be of benefit, which I think we've said right from the start. Under the right circumstances, it can be beneficial. It can really smooth the presentation and improve visually how the game's played, but it doesn't boost your performance in the sense that you're not really like going from 60 to 120 FPS. It's really still the input and everything's played at 60 FPS, but you get this mm-hmm. bit more clarity of 120 FPS, which can be nice.
Yeah.
But it can also be a complete waste of time and of no benefit, depending on the type of game you're playing. If it's a latency-sensitive title where the smoothing's not so much the issue, I mean, that is good, but you also mm-hmm. want the latency benefit first and probably foremost.
Yeah, I think as well as people have gotten more used to using the technology, like you got your hands on it, it's with something like frame generation, it can be a little difficult on first impression, like the very first time you use it, to notice the latency difference, often because you might just turn it on and you're not really doing as much comparison like A versus B. What does 60 FPS with no frame gen feel like compared to 120 FPS that's real frames mm-hmm. versus 120 mm-hmm. FPS generated frames? But then as time goes on, you play with it more, you experiment, you play some games that run at higher frame rates without frame gen, you use some that have, you know, frame gen enabled. You get more experience using the technology, you find its strengths and weaknesses. And I think most people that have now used it in a whole variety of conditions have come to a very similar sort of conclusion and sort of just acknowledge that it is what it is. It's the technology is presented, it does what it does, it has some benefits some of the time, it has other weaknesses at other times. So yeah, I think there's still maybe a few people that, you know, say that they don't notice the latency impacts of things like frame generation. That's great, because if you're using it, you like using it, you don't notice the latency, amazing. It will be a revolutionary technology for you. Don't want to minimize those people's experiences or anything. But yeah, I think with these sorts of questions, it is very much, yeah, we're more than a year in now where mm-hmm. we're almost coming up to another GPU generation. So there's been plenty of time for people to get their heads around what it does. Yeah.
All right, that is going to do it for part one of the April Q&A series. Probably going to be a three-part series like we usually do when we end up doing the Q&As. But yeah, a lot of different questions, I feel. Repetitive ones that we sometimes get sucked into. But yeah, so I guess good job to you guys for asking some good questions for once. Fire out, making our job a bit easier.
Oh, they're not going to watch part two now.
Yeah.
We've just roasted them.
All right, rewind. Edit that out, Balin. We'd just like to say that we love our viewers, appreciate them dearly. Yep. Thank you for asking great questions. Part one is over. So Float Plane Patreon, if you want some more abuse, you can head over there and you can talk to me in person on our Discord server. I'll tell you what for there. We do some behind-the-scenes content where it's more of the same. Q&A stuff, which we're doing right now, and a live stream, so I can also let you have it live. If you're a...
Do you reckon people would pay more money for you to abuse them? It's a possibility. Maybe that's a business venture for us.
Something we're going to look into in the future for sure. All right, thanks for watching part one. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Tim.
See you next time.